Eddie, I've been listening to you for maybe all my life. My parents are big jazz fans, so my father would have put on Crossings because that was one of his favorite albums, you know.
Oh, that goes way back.
Yes. So your sound is very, feels very close to me, and I think in 1999 or 2000 I saw you with Herbie and the Gershwin's World band in Düsseldorf.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I remember that distinctly.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, great. Me too, that particular concert.
You were there?
I was there. I saw you in Düsseldorf, and maybe I had just learned to play, I thought I had learned to play Cantaloupe Island. And I had no idea what you were doing. And I still remember this feeling of having no clue, but loving it. You know, this particular feeling? It's a beautiful combination.
It's like lost in space.
Exactly. Yes.
It's a nice feeling.
Yes. Do you remember when you had that feeling?
Oh, every time I play with Herbie Hancock.
Yeah?
Yeah. Because Herbie used to have a little mechanism. He would pretend, like if there's four beats, he would pretend that one is two or four is one to throw himself out. He says being lost is the motor to his inspiration.
Beautiful, yeah. I played with John Scofield and he told me that his impression of Herbie, playing with Herbie, was that Herbie was trying to get lost on purpose because
this is true.
Where he felt it was happening.
Yeah. Then he's just like lost in the void, right? You know, and then that's the excitement for him. Right. That's kind of became the excitement for me playing that kind of music. It's not bebop where change is, you know, dogmatic. Just right there when you're out in space. And it's a collective effort. Everybody's listening to each other. And that's the excitement for me.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, how did you... I just read in a book that I revisited about the M1 Dishibet. I read that you, before you played with Herbie, you studied that music very closely. And you were very well prepared for the first opportunity that you had with Herbie.
A little better, but I had listened to his record, his previous records, like Empyrean Isles, Speak Like a Child, Maiden Voyage, all that repertoire. And so when, you know, he really didn't even know I played trumpet, so he put some music up in front of me at the only rehearsal, and I could read pretty well. And so he had the band play it, I had the music. And so he looks at me and says, oh, you read pretty good. I said, you know, thanks. I was just doing it from memory, from listening to the record.
It's a good trick.
Yeah.
So you learned...
I could have read the music even if I hadn't heard it, but it wasn't even necessary.
Yeah. Do you remember during this first rehearsal what the tunes were that you were learning together with Herbie then?
I think we played, it was actually all the repertoire from Speak Like a Child album. Right. I Have a Dream, Speak Like a Child, Toys. It was before the M1 Dishi concept. Yeah.
But had you seen the band with Johnny Coles, the sextet?
Oh, yes.
You saw the band?
I saw the band with Garnett Brown, Johnny Coles, Joe Henderson, Tootie Heath, and Buster Williams. So I had a little precursor, you know, rehearsal in my mind of how the music should sound. Yeah.
So what was your impression of that band?
Oh, they were great. I mean, they were all my heroes. Mm-hmm. You know, I never dreamed that I was going to be able to play with people on that level. And then when Johnny Coles went on a sabbatical with Herbie, went on a sabbatical with Ray Charles, I think, for 6 months, Herbie needed a trumpet player for 1 week. Mm-hmm. And I got that gig on the recommendation of Woody Shaw, because Woody Shaw actually did the week before, but he was out in San Francisco playing with Joe Henderson, so he couldn't make the week in San Francisco, so he recommended me, and that's how I got the gig. Yeah, and that 1 week turned into the rest of my life.
Beautiful.
Is that
With M1 Dishy, I've read that you, Herbie used to listen to specific kinds of music before the show, sometimes together with the whole band, like Ravel, Daphnis et Chloé, and
Yes, he also just right around the time that the M1 Dishy concept, the advent of that happened. We were in Chicago, and Herbie was listening to Stockhausen.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
All these different kind of voices coming in randomly, and that kind of, and he had the band listening to that. It kind of formulated, because you know, no jazz, quote unquote jazz band, had ever played that kind of concept before, and so we, of course, you know, I've been listening to classical music all my life: Ravel, Stravinsky, Rimsky-Korsakov, Debussy, and Herbie loved Debussy. Yeah. Obviously, just by the way he plays, you can tell that, you know, the specific way he plays.
Did Herbie point out specific things while you guys were listening to music together?
No.
Like, it was just to get into the mood and...
Herbie never dictated what anybody should play or what anybody should listen to. He let everybody, you know, follow their own instincts. I tell many people, you know, Herbie never told me how to play or what to play, or anybody in the band how to play or what to play. He hired racehorses, so he just let them run.
Beautiful. Yeah, and he hired the right guys. I mean, what a combination of people.
It's, my God. Mm-hmm. It was a dream band, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think everybody in that band, Buster Williams, Billy Hart, Herbie, Benny Maupin, myself and Julian Priester, they had all been out on the road. That was my first experience of ever playing with people of that caliber. I had never traveled on the road before. They had been out there, but I don't think, you know, they had been out there for a week or two at a time on gigs within different chemistries of bands, but I don't think anybody in that band had ever played music with a chemistry like that, where the band had longevity, because we were together for over 3 years.
Yeah.
And worked like, Jesus Christ, 9 months a year for 3 years. Mm-hmm. That's unheard of.
Yeah.
And especially in that day and age, you know.
Yeah. Do you have specific memories from being in the studio with that band? Like things that you really like to think back to?
Absolutely. That first record that I did, M1 Dishy, because that was the first time I'd ever been in a studio. My first time. So everybody in the band used to call me the rookie of the year, which I was. To those guys, I was like a novice. But every time I talk about that particular record, I can see it in my mind's eye, how everything looked. It was like surrealistic, and Panavision, Technicolor, everything. Mm. It was like supernatural people. You know, didn't even look real. Very surrealistic.
Yeah,
I can just see the vision in my mind, and that's the main one that I can remember. Mm-hmm. That first album, I think it was recorded in 1970.
70 or 71, something like
70
that.
70 or 71, yes.
Yeah, yeah. I'm particularly drawn to those moments where, this is something that I wanted to ask you about. Like, I think you have the rare gift of, And that's something that also that I admire about Miles. Like, there could be the most crazy thing happening before you put the trumpet into your mouth and play. Like, you're like a group improvisation, multi-directional thing. And you have the gift, and I want to learn how this works, of challenging, channeling everything with the thing that you play. Like, being super focused and putting, like, whatever happened to before, you put it all into a new context when you start playing. Like, how do you do that?
Bring it together. I think that particular quality, I used to observe Miles do that before I joined Herbie Hancock's group. It should be like crazy stuff happening. He just waited, listened to what was happening, put his horn in his mouth, hit one note, and everything just like magnetically comes together.
That's it.
Yeah. You can't do that with everybody, but with that particular chemistry of musicians and musical beings, everybody was listening to each other, and it afforded the opportunity to do something like that, you know. Mm-hmm. But you say, you've seen me do that, observed me doing that. I got that directly from observing Miles very closely for many, many years.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
But there's
And Herbie Hancock, who was Miles' piano player. So, you know, Buster Williams and Billy Hart all played with Miles. So it wasn't anything new for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Just in the place of Miles Davis, utilizing that particular tool.
But there's also something to be said, like, of course, yes, you learn it from a figure like Miles, but also you have to be able to actually hear something while all of this is happening.
Absolutely.
Like, how did you work on being able to hear and to formulate and to focus and really play what you hear?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. You know, when I was before that time, when I was playing, I'm getting ready to play, I would always have something pre-planned when I was going to come in and play. When I first joined Herbie Hancock, I tried to do that. It sounded like the band was around the corner having sandwiches, and I was by myself.
Right.
I learned that you can never have anything pre-planned to play. It's right at the moment.
Yeah.
Of what's happening at that particular moment.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think ahead. I can't think behind about what happened. I have to be right there at that instant. Then something spontaneous can happen, like we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it takes courage also to be that vulnerable also, right?
It takes courage and trust.
Yeah.
Ultimate trust. Mm-hmm. And I learned to trust all those people. And many times I would fall down, and the man was, oh, God, come on, get up. You know, everybody's looking at you, Eddie. You know, it was impossible to make a mistake. Like Herbie Hancock taught me that. If you make a mistake, there's no way, I learned there's no way to play a wrong note. Everything became valid. So sometimes I feel like I didn't play well. I said, oh, Herbie, I'm sorry. He said, oh, no, we just played that.
Yeah.
And that. It's just as valid as this.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing wrong. When you hear a sound in nature, you can't say that's wrong.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It just is.
Yeah.
So that particular concept kind of rubbed off on the way I approached music from that point on.
Beautiful. Thank you for checking out this episode. If you enjoy these conversations, please consider joining me on patreon.com/pabloheld. My Patreon community helps me to pay for the running costs of this podcast and to develop it further into the future. There's two ways to join me there. The interview tier will give you access to lots of behind-the-scenes content. And also, you get every episode before everybody else gets. So that's early access to episodes. The other option is the music lessons tier, which will give you everything from the interviews tier, plus two video lessons on different topics each month. Lead sheets, so whenever I transcribe a new song, you'll get it first. You'll be invited to listening sessions and much more. So these are two options for you to join me there. By doing that, you will be helping me to continue this podcast. So thank you, and let's get back to the episode.
Yeah.
Did you have a favorite piece that you played with the band? Like, what was your favorite piece of that repertoire?
Well, the one that stands out to me is the tune You'll Know When You Get There.
Yeah.
On the original Mwandishi album. That's sort of... And Ostinato.
Mm-hmm.
That was on the first album. Yeah. It's sort of like wide open spaces.
Yeah.
You know, there was a tonality based on some sort of tonality or other, or a certain rhythm. And whatever you played was valid.
Beautiful.
You know, and that kind of really opened my ears and my musical soul up and as an approach to improvising.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was always wondering about You'll Know When You Get There was first written for Eastern Airlines commercial.
Yes.
But did you also record this with the band for the airlines, or was this a separate version?
Well, actually, the Eastern Airlines commercial was first. It's only 30 seconds. And then nobody improvised, just played that melody. Boom, 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 ping. Boom, 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 boom. It was very exotic, floating sound. So then we got on the gig that night. Herbie said, "Oh, let's play that melody and see what happens."
Mm.
And then things started to take form.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Wow, this could be the concept of the band, of the Mwandishi concept." And that's how it began.
Mm.
Isn't that something?
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Was there a song from the repertoire that you wish you guys played more often? Was there a song that you wish you guys would have developed a little bit more and played more live on the road?
Well, we kind of played everything live. Sometimes, you know, I'd say at least three or four times. You know, usual bands, they go to a gig, they might play three sets a night. Twice I remember in Boston, the gig started at 9:30 or 9 o'clock at night, supposed to play at 9, 11, and 12:30. We started at 9, ended the first set, played one tune on the first set, and the first set ended at 2 o'clock.
Ooh.
From 9 to no intermission, just a big cosmic exposure. We started off with You'll Know When You Get There, and we went
did you get there?
Went everywhere. So in terms of I wish I played this tune or that tune, we played every night. We played more than we could have hoped for.
Right.
More than you could have imagined.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable.
Yeah. I have many live recordings from this group.
Oh, and, you do? So you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Because I'm for me, it's always interesting to hear the Mwandishi repertoire, but then how you guys mixed it up with older pieces, like Maiden Voyage and Speak Like a Child, because then the You Know when You Get There concept happens to Speak Like a Child, which is so out there. I just listened to Hamburg. You guys played in Hamburg 1971, and you played Speak Like a Child for a long time.
I remember that because that was our first tour, first time I ever went to Europe, and I remember Hamburg in 71.
Mm.
I do remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The version that you guys played of Speak Like a Child is so incredible and so out there. Wow.
Completely different from the original record.
Exactly.
Right.
that A minor vamp opens up for like the universe to, you know.
It expanded to infinity. It did that every night. Can you imagine working for 3.5 years, 9 to 10 months a year? I mean, wow. the man evolved so many different places.
Mm-hmm.
It's unbelievable.
How did it feel for you, Eddie, when then half of the band ends up on Miles's On the Corner during that time of being you know, intensely in that band?
Yeah.
They go to the recording session and go, kind of Miles takes the band a little bit. How did it feel for you?
Well, you know, it was right in the middle of the M1DC period that I was in Herbie's band at that time. And I remember hearing Miles In the Corner, but in terms of what I was involved in with the M1DC band, it sounded funny to me.
Yeah.
It really did. As much as I loved and revered Miles,
of course.
I said, what the hell is he doing? Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
But, you know, Miles Davis is a visionary. You know, he always wanted to do something new. So what can you say about him?
Mm-hmm.
He's special. Yeah,
and he noticed that there was something happening with this band.
Oh, absolutely. Always. And Miles Davis is always going to have something happening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
He also came to your gigs, right? He came to the M1 Dishy gigs and
he
checked out the band.
He right in front of me, stared down at my throat. but I knew him since I was 17 years old.
Yeah.
He used to stay at my parents' house.
Yep.
And
give you lessons also a little bit, right? He was also teaching you a little bit on the trumpet.
Say what now?
He was also giving you lessons from time to time on the trumpet when you were coming up, right?
Never in the formal sense.
Oh.
Lessons I got from him were just by observation. He never sat down and said, this is this and that's that and do this. It wasn't like that.
Okay.
In the strict sense of a lesson, he never did that with me.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember one time he came to the gig, and I saw him. He came in the back, and I said, you know, hey man, why don't you stop BSing? So he said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, two trumpets. You know, it's nothing new. There's Herb Alpert, Hugh Masekela, Dizzy Gillespie, Fats Navarro. Howard McGee and somebody else, John Faddis and Dizzy Gillespie, you ought to hire another trumpet, meaning me, you know. So he said, oh, don't start me thinking about that. So I turned around and said, you already are, and turned around and walked away. So he said, wait a minute. And so he said, hey, here's my number. Call me tomorrow and let's talk about the money. I said, okay. So I took I was at my mother's house in the Bronx. So I took the subway down to his house, knocked on his door, you know, the little peephole in the door.
Mm-hmm.
Undeniably, Miles Davis's eye. And all I could hear was, sad motherfucker. Never answered the door. I said, that was my fault. I should have known better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He likes to play.
Wow. And then with M1DISHY, after the breakup of the band, there's a transitional period where a lot of you guys still play together on each other's records. And like, how was that time for you guys? I feel like there was a lot of love between all of you and you kind of still wanted to stay together.
Oh, absolutely. When he announced that he was going to break up the band, I was heartbroken. The reason he did, because, you know, during that 3.5 year period that we were together, when we worked, everybody got $300 a week. But we had to pay our own hotel bills, our bills at home. But that was big money then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nowadays you couldn't buy a candy bar. You know? But when he broke it up, he wasn't even getting paid. He supported that band for 3 years. out of the royalties he had accrued to support the band, just to do that particular, you know, experiment. So he was in debt to his manager, David Rubinson, $30,000. So David could not control musically that band. So David Rubinson told Herbie, either give me my money or get rid of these guys. That's when Herbie, on the side, started rehearsing the Headhunters band. Mm. But we didn't even know it. He told us he was going to go back to school and study orchestration. I was heartbroken, so I told Herbie, I said, hey, man, if you need some money, I'll rob a bank. Don't break up the band. You know? But he had to do what he had to do. Mm-hmm. And but as you say, even after he broke up the band, the remainder of the personnel in the band, when we played together, there was so much love and camaraderie. It was obvious.
Yeah, on your records as well, Herbie showed up, and most of the band shows up. You know, on Realization and on Mahal. Oh, yeah. And, you know.
Well, actually, the Mwadishi band was still together on Realization.
Mm, oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, but they were just gracious enough to put it under my name. That was really Herbie Hancock's band.
Right, yeah, I see what you mean. But there's also like the albums with Norman Connors and, you know, and Benny's albums and, you know.
Exactly, and Mahal, Herbie played on that, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I wrote to you yesterday, Ecstasy. I wrote to you yesterday. I want to know about Ecstasy, the duo track between you guys.
One take of that. I just wrote out a little. I didn't write out all the notes. The part I was playing was just improvised at the moment.
Yeah.
There was no particular melody. And I just wrote out a sketch of the chords for Herbie. We did it in one take, and it was never did another one. It was undeniably magic, as you heard.
Yes, it sounds so fresh.
Yeah.
So fresh. I listened to it yesterday.
Herbie, it's like that.
Yeah. I listened to it yesterday like 7 times in a row, or like I couldn't stop listening. And it was on repeat.
Yeah, I love that particular cut.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's another track that's outside of Mwadishi now, but the Shades? Is it Shades? There's another song of yours on a newer album where it seems to me that like there's no melody, but there's a set of chords. Some of them a little bit reminiscent of the Spanish.
Didn't they call that reminiscent of Ecstasy?
No. Reminiscent of that concept of just having chords without a melody, like Flamenco Sketches type of.
On my album?
Yeah.
Well, Herbie and I did a duo on the last album I did on Capitol called Malana.
Mm-hmm.
It was similar to Ecstasy.
I'll check that out. I'm not sure about this one, but this is with either Dave Kikoski or Kevin Hayes. I'm not sure who.
Okay.
Beautiful.
No, was it Herbie?
No. An album from the 2000s or something, or 90s or something. Okay. Yeah,
I don't remember. Sorry.
It's a lot of music you've put out, you know.
Oh, yeah. Seemingly.
Yeah. That's something that I wanted to ask you about. Like, okay, let's put it this way. Like, a lot of people are scared of the iconic, timeless recordings and especially songs. Like, if somebody calls Blue and Green, some people go like, yeah, I just have the recording so much in my ear, I don't know if I can approach Blue and Green. I feel like you're drawn to these pieces especially, and you go towards them with no fear and with a fresh approach, and I kind of have the feeling that you're fueled by the timelessness of the initial recordings, like Blue and Green, Dance Cadaverous, It Never Entered My Mind. Those
tunes. Well, you hit the nail on the head. I can't explain that. I mean, all the tunes you've mentioned, Dance Cadavers, It never entered my mind, Blue and Green, even All Blues, too, something yes. like that. So stylized. There you go.
That's my favorite Eddie Henderson record. That's my favorite.
What is that?
That's So What.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
What? I love that album.
Yeah. On that particular album, obviously, it was dedicated to Miles's music, but I made the stipulation to everybody on the day. They had heard all the original recordings on Kind of Blue and stuff, but I said, whatever we do, we're going to play the same tune, but do not do it like the original recording. Whatever you do, don't try to imitate the original recording. And they facilitated that whoosh, and so it freed everybody up.
Oh yeah,
played in the same concept, but not like, because those original recordings were so stylized and iconic. It's easy to fall into the trap of trying to imitate, but we said do not do that.
Mm.
You know, I think we pulled it off.
Oh yeah, you did.
Yeah.
Yes. And the cool thing is, like, I hear the original, somehow it's ringing, but I'm hearing a new take on it.
Absolutely. You know?
It's two things are embracing, you know, embracing each other.
Yeah, yeah. There's one thing that I wanted to comment on. You mentioned, I think when you heard that band, Herbie's band, play Cantaloupe Island.
Yeah.
And you said, what are they doing? You didn't know what we were doing. It's because the bass player at that time, Ira Coleman, do you remember him?
Yes, of course.
Yeah. For some reason, every night, he kept messing it up and jumping ahead two beats or pulling it, missing a beat here and there. So finally, before that particular concert, Herbie said, well, since you insist, okay, we'll do it like that. And that was the arrangement.
It's cool, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people. Huh?
This arrangement kind of, in a way, also ended up on one of your albums.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's very cool. With there's a short, like, there's a 3-4 bar at the end of the form when it goes
exactly.
Down.
We subtract there's an F minor for 4 bars. Then there's a D flat and F minor, D flat, and then a D minor.
Right.
On the D flat, we subtract 2 beats, and coming out of the D minor, subtract 1 beat.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very cool to compare these. I have a couple of bootlegs from the Gershwin's World Band, and then to compare it with your recording from your album.
Oh yeah,
it's really, really cool to see what you guys did with this.
Yeah, the evolution of it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you've done your homework well.
I just love the music. I love the music. I listen to it. You know.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah. There's one question I have for you. Is the thing is, I hear when I hear you, I hear the love. For your idols also. I hear how where you're coming from without mimicking it, without copying it. I hear I love hearing influences. I love this. This is like family. But what I'm always drawn, like with Herbie is my guy. Maybe you've already noticed this, but Herbie is my guy.
Me too.
You know? So with Herbie, I've learned so much about Herbie when I started to check out his influences rather than just checking out Herbie. So
exactly.
This is whenever I love somebody's music, I go back and try to find out who their heroes were.
Exactly.
You know, I wonder what is your take on that with your heroes and in general, like thinking about what does influences tell you about the artist themselves?
Yeah. Well, Herbie, he told me out of his mouth that one of his main influences when he was coming up before he joined Miles Davis was Ahmad Jamal. He'd go listen to him every night, you know. And also, you know, he loved the people from the bebop era Of course, he loved Bud Powell, and he liked Monk, he liked McCoy. He was aware of them, but he didn't want to play like them. Some people try to imitate their heroes. Herbie told me it's good to emulate them up to a point, but not 100%. Try to emulate it, get every note down. Just be aware of them and then leave it alone. Mm. And then just that little influence will rub off. I used to try to play exactly like Miles, listen to the records. I used to try to play just like Lee Morgan, note for note, with the little innuendos. So I used to go over his house and practice with it. I used to practice with Freddie Hubbard. I wanted to play like Freddie Hubbard up to a point, you know. Then Woody Shaw and I used to practice together. I liked the way he played, but the way Woody played, I just didn't hear like that. You know, finally I realized, well, who am I? You know, emulate all these other people and put, hopefully all those emulations or influence will rub off and just expand my vocabulary. People ask me, they say, well, Eddie, I like your style. My style? It's just what I've copied. Right, and scotch taped together. That's my style.
But that's only you can do this. Because there's only one Eddie Henderson. So only you have your taste. You only have your love for a certain kind of people, but that's the combination that you put together based on where you're coming from.
Yeah, people always talk about Miles Davis style or Miles Davis sound as if he just dropped out of the sky in a vacuum. Miles Davis's hero, who he copied, that not that many people know of, was, as you know, Freddie West.
Yeah,
of course. But so I remember when I first met Miles, the first time I played with Sketches of Spain at my parents' house for him, I didn't miss a note, right? And so I walked up, I'm 17 years old. I said, well, how did you like that, Miles? He said, in his voice, he said, you sound good, but that's me. And so then the next year he came back, he knocked on the door, I answered the door, so first thing he said, hey, Eddie, you still trying to sound like me? But I had found out about Freddie Webster. I said, you mean Freddie Webster? If you had seen the look on his face, he didn't expect that. So he smiled and whispered in my ear. He said, everybody's a thief. I just made a short-term loan.
Yeah,
so that's how that goes. No, he emulated that. But actually, he tried to copy it, but not that many people were, because Freddie Webster didn't record that much. And so not that many people in the listening world knew. They just thought Miles Davis's style. Mm. And I'm sure Freddie Webster, had his heroes too before him. You always have to be aware of your predecessors, because that's where the music came from.
Yeah.
Be aware of them, emulate them, don't copy them, because you want the music to go on and perpetuate itself, you know, towards future generations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing those memories also of practicing with Lee Morgan, with Freddie Hubbard. With that's when I hear something like this, you know, I want to know. I want to know what you guys did. I want to know what it was like to practice with them.
I got a little story that you will enjoy. First time I went over to Freddie Hubbard's house, I was intimidated, you know. But he was nice, very kind. And for four years I drive up from Washington D.C. and Saturday morning, I'd be at Freddie Hubbard's house just watching him practice, emulating what he practiced, write it down, you know. On Sunday morning, I'd go to Lee Morgan's house. He was very gracious. He says, get out your horn, Eddie. Put on the Arban book, 60 duets, and one of the duets called Bolero. You know, I remember I knew it by heart since I was 12 years old, but I pretend I was reading just like Herbie's Audition, pretend like I was reading. So he said, you want to play the top line or the bottom? I said, well, I'll play the bottom, you Lee Morgan. So he was actually, his shoulder was physically touching my shoulder. By the time we got to the second bar, I realized that Lee Morgan was going out of his way to blend with me. The great Lee Morgan, and here I'm just a beginner, right? Mm. And so it was like an electric shock. I scream, like that. Lee took off his glasses just like this. He looked at me and said, you dig? You dig? Yeah. In other words, no matter who you're playing with, go out of your way to touch their soul through the medium of sound. Whether you're the great Lee Morgan or the lesser Eddie Henderson, he was going out of his way to make music with me. And that's not written in books in school. No. So I got from the horse's mouth. He said that's what Clifford Brown did to him when he used to go over Clifford's house when he was 15 years old. And Cliff would show him all the licks that Clifford played, that Lee Morgan played, and passed on to me. And I passed this knowledge on to all my students.
Beautiful. To now. Wow. Thanks for sharing that.
Oh, my pleasure.
Wow. When you think of Lee Morgan now, you can't talk to him right now, but if you could, what would you ask him?
What would I ask him?
Mm-hmm.
I really never asked him anything. Mm-hmm. It was more or less by observation. We'd play together, I'd listen and play. He'd invite me up on his gigs to play, and he was always very encouraging. Mm. Oh, you sound great, Eddie. And then he would get on the mic and said, yeah, that was Eddie Henderson, That's the last time I'm going to invite him up on my bandstand. He plays so good. He was cute. But just the humor he played with, the sense that when he played a ballad, Lee Morgan, and he was sassy, he was humorous, he was thoughtful, and so creative, And of course, he studied his predecessors, Clifford Brown, Dizzy Gillespie, and all the predecessors on the trumpet before him. And he really carried the torch. And even Freddie Hubbard said, as much technical prowess that Freddie had, he said the only one that intimidated him was Lee Morgan. Because Freddie, if he played first, and Lee Morgan would come in and play three notes and would get housed from the audience. and I asked Art Blakey, who did he like better, Clifford Brown, Freddie Hubbard, or Lee? Art Blakey, who played with all of them, he says, Clifford's dead. I don't know what Freddie's doing. Lee Morgan, he plays from the heart. Whoa.
Mm, wow.
What a mouthful.
Yeah.
That's
beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. I had the opportunity to be around all those guys. It was so inspiring.
Mm.
So inspiring.
We just lost Roy Haynes.
Huh?
We just lost Roy Haynes. You played with him also. I read you played with Roy Haynes.
Yes, I did. The first day that Art Blakey hired me, I was in Central Park. This is 3 weeks after the Mwadishi group ended. Art Blakey called me and said, you want to be a manager? I said, sure. So the gig was in New York. I flew there, and half of the set, Roy Haynes came up on Art Blakey's gig, and two drummers at once. And that was my first day with Art Blakey. And actually, that was recorded. I understand that it just came out.
I haven't heard this.
Art Blakey, 1973, in Central Park.
I'll check it out.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, he was great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very nice man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was always wondering how your practicing of psychiatry, studying medicine and psychiatry, how this affected you as a musician and a creative person.
Okay, that's a misnomer. I have a medical degree, and I specialize in psychiatry only because the on-call schedule was once every 45 days, as opposed to once every other day if I did surgery or pediatrics. So once every 45 days allowed me to play the trumpet more.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the reason I veered towards psychiatry, but I never practiced psychiatry. I only practiced general medicine.
I see.
Now in terms of, well, what was the question again?
Like how this affected you as a musician?
It didn't help me play a C scale better. Did not. You know, it was just one thing I did. It affected me in terms of the discipline of studying medicine, the discipline of studying in the medical field and psychiatry, you know, studying, going to class every day. Went over in terms of the discipline of me practicing the trumpet every day too. So just that discipline I learned at an early age facilitated, the way I approach playing music. Discipline.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
And all the people that I admired, like Freddie Hubbard, Lee, John Coltrane, of course, you know, they've practiced every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Did you ever have social interaction with Coltrane also?
Social?
Yeah.
I met him when he was playing with Miles Davis when I was in high school. He used to come up by parents' house. I mean, I was so in awe of him. It was unbelievable. I remember one time in the middle of medical school, I went up and, like a fool, brought my horn in the club. And so he asked me, you want to play something, Eddie? I got cottonmouth. I got scared. No. My mom dried up. I said, no, man, I'm in school. And ran out and put my horn in the trunk of my car and locked it. And then came back in. I said, whoa. My heart was still beating.
Yeah.
Just that he even asked me that.
Yeah.
Hell no. Not getting the best head with that man.
Mm-hmm. Which lineup would this have been? Was it with Elvin? Was it with Elvin and McCoy and Jimmy Garrison? Or
with Elvin and McCoy? It's just sort of a derivative of playing with Coltrane.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I used to see them when they played with John Coltrane.
Yeah,
and what an honor it was that they asked me to play with in Elvin's sextet and McCoy's sextet and McCoy's big band for many years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In the liner notes to Friday Night at the Black Hawk, you wrote, I really like your liner notes on that one, and you wrote a sentence that resonated with me, and it was, Miles' lines would cut through the changes vertically.
Oh, what, did I say that?
Yes, I want to know about this.
The way he played would permeate right through the changes. He would play melodies as opposed to, you know, oompa, 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 the changes. He'd go,
yeah,
right to the point. Yeah. That's the way it affected me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were talking about cutting through the lines vertically.
Yes.
And I think that's also what I adore also about your playing is like you're able to find those special notes, the special notes in the chord, you know, how they come out and how they shine.
Oh, yeah. I think Miles, when I was very young, he just talking to him one time about this particular aspect of music, he called those consonant notes the butter notes.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and so he told me, just play the butter notes. This is around the time of Someday My Prince Will Come.
Right.
And then as he evolved, I remember Herbie one time told me that if you listen to that album called Miles Smiles, remember that album where they played Gingerbread Boy, for example. And the way Herbie is playing, Miles told Herbie, do not play the butter notes.
Yeah.
So Herbie said for about a week, he looked like a praying mantis. Looking at the keyboard, he didn't know what to play. he go to play the butter note. That's what he heard. And he said, oh, whoa. And then all of a sudden he realized. And then he spread the deck, and he was free then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, use all the 12 tones.
Yeah.
The butter and the salty notes.
Yeah, and more.
The sweet or the unsweetened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, but when you're first learning, just play the butter notes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, that's what the chord dictates, you know. But there's another side, too. The non-butter notes. Mm-hmm. And that's when you can really take off and have some fun. Because there are no wrong notes, you know. It's just a sound, a color, a rub of sound that most people in Western music are used to hearing the butter notes. You turn on the radio, you hear somebody singing the butter notes. But if you go to India, a place like that, you have quarter tones. Mm-hmm. It sounds really creepy. But after living in India for a while, they sound like butter notes.
Exactly. It's just a matter of perspective and
absolutely
experience also.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What we talked about earlier, the iconic tunes, I feel like when I look at all the records that you've put out and when I listen to them, I feel like you have, and we talked about this before, like you don't shy away from really going to those iconic pieces of the time of your life, basically, like so Zoltan, that you play Zoltan, you know, from Unity, all of those things. Like my question is, how do you put together a repertoire for a record?
Mm-hmm.
How do you think about it?
If I have an upcoming record,
yeah,
I try to think of the songs that have touched my life and my evolution from the time I started that I always wanted to play. And if I heard them on the record, the golden rule is be aware of the concept that they approached it. But if you're going to do it, don't do it just like the record.
Yeah.
That's one thing. But in terms of picking, like I'm supposed to have another record day coming up in a couple of months. And I really don't have the repertoire even together yet. I'm really not a composer. You know, I learned to just write sketches and just let the rest of the personnel in the band, make a collective effort rather than a self-portrait, than me writing all the notes. I like a collective portrait. And that far supersedes any self-portrait.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way I compose things.
Mm-hmm.
But I always try to pick tunes that people have not heard that much, or iconic tunes that they have heard, and just try to put a little different cap on it.
Mm-hmm. And how do you get to the different cap on it?
One thing is picking the chemistry of people in the band, you know, rather than just people that I know what I'm talking about in terms of that awareness. Be aware of those iconic tunes, but don't do it like the record.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people like Dave Kukoski, Kevin Hayes.
Yeah.
I love those guys.
Yeah.
Billy Hart. Buster Williams, you know, people who have been around a long time who understand that awareness, as opposed to hiring younger musicians who play well, but they don't have that experience and that awareness yet under their belt.
And like, okay, let's say you found a piece of you narrowed down a list of pieces. How do you prepare them for the band? Do you transcribe from the original? Do you go to the composer and ask for a sheet? Do you just name the tune and ask everybody else to just learn it? Or how do you usually go about
it? I just get a lead sheet and bring it into the rehearsal. You know, and they've heard the original recording before, if it's one of those kind of tunes. And I, you know, then they say, oh, yeah, I've played this before. I said, you played it before? But let's not do it like the record, but get another bass line. Like, for example, on the album of mine, So What, Footprints.
Oh, yes. Boom.
Yeah, boom. Yeah, the bass line.
Yes.
I just made up a different bass line.
Yes.
It's completely different, the different vibe.
Oh, it sets a totally different vibe. And also the way that Billy plays on it, like he finds a different kind of groove for it. And
exactly.
Yes.
Isn't that Victor Lewis playing on that?
I thought Footprints was Billy, but I might be wrong. I don't know.
I don't know. I might be wrong too. I don't really, well, whoever the drummer was, they played different.
Yeah, they did.
We concur on that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Also, well, you needn't always sticks in my mind how you play the melody and how you not play the whole melody. You play.
Well, I got that from Miles.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I got that from Miles Davis at the Blackhawk. If you listen to that, where he plays verbatim.
Yeah.
I copied just like the record.
Yeah, but it does something to how the band then treats that information. Yeah. They treated it in a different way. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And how does it work? How do you learn a standard?
Just by rote memory. Rote memory. Learn the melody.
Yeah.
That's how I do it first. First, I learn the melody verbatim without any embellishments.
Yeah,
and then I attach the chords to it and see how the chords are related to the melody, and that's a learning experience in itself.
Yeah,
because those old composers and especially lyricists, every tune you know has some meaning to it. Learn the words to the tune, so you know what the tune means, then you can interpret it validly. In a valid context. That's why I approach learning a new tune.
Yeah.
If it doesn't have words, to at least learn the melody. So if I get lost when I'm improvising, I always have the melody going on in my mind's eye, you know, to keep my bearings. And then if I do get lost, stop, look, and listen to the bass. You know, the root note, then I'll get in my place.
Yeah. How was it for you during the time of M1 Dishi? Were you still learning new standards at the time, you know?
No, I wasn't even thinking about standards at that time.
Okay.
I was just playing that particular music. After the M1 Dishi group ended, I was more or less playing like Open Skies, you know, when you get there. I really had not that strict guidelines. Then after that ended, I realized that I had a weakness in my understanding of playing changes, of playing standard tunes. And that's why there's a gap, the little gap around the 80s until the early 90s. When I came back on Steeplechase, I started playing tunes with chords.
Yeah,
because I made a conscious effort to learn how to play changes.
How did you do that? Can you describe this time? Because I noticed also in your discography there is a gap of no records, almost no records in the 80s.
I felt that I wasn't ready to record anything, because after M1 Dishi, I was supported by those guys who were above me, you know, musically. And I just was like kind of sailing on the top of the crest of the wave. But in terms of me really knowing what I was doing, I didn't, be truthful. And so I went back and studied just basic how to play on the blues, how to play Green Dolphin Street, Up Jump Spring, Well You Needn't, Donna Lee, Cherokee, tunes like that, step by step, and, you know, relationships, and that has led me up to the present learning process. Because you can't build a skyscraper unless you have the foundation. Oh, yeah. I felt that my foundation was weak. So that's why I kind of backed off, didn't record, and just come in gracefully, come back gracefully, hopefully.
Yeah, you did. Oh, man, of course. And this kind of prepared you to be there then for the Gershwin's World Tour, you know, where there was a mixture of that open freeness of in certain songs where Herbie was kind of inviting this kind of texture back into the playing.
Oh, absolutely.
But also on top of tunes.
Kind of, you know, yeah. Exactly.
How was that experience for you? Can you share some memories from those tours?
Yeah, it was certainly apropos in terms of what we're talking about right now. It allowed me the opportunity to show how I had grown since the Mwandishi period, you know. And I'm sure Herbie enjoyed it also from being out in space, coming back to Earth and playing the butternotes.
Yeah. Yeah, I just heard a bootleg where you guys played I Loves You Porgy as well, which isn't on the album.
Yes.
The way that you guys played this particular tune.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember that vividly in the studio, just seeing Herbie, Ira Coleman, and who was it, Lewis Nash? I don't remember the...
Terry Lynn Carrington.
Oh, on that tour.
On the tour was Terry Lynn Carrington. I think also on the record is also Terry Lynn.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I was just enthralled with Herbie. Playing so beautiful. Yeah.
I was trying to transcribe Cottontail, the arrangement of Cottontail.
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell me how you guys put this together? I know what's happening harmonically now, but how did you learn that song together with Herbie?
Well, up to that point, I had never played it before, to tell you the truth. Herbie more or less kind of rearranged the changes on the bridge.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And he just told me what it was. I said, okay. You know, the outside part was pretty straightforward. You know, it's AABA. On the B part, he rearranged the changes. I remember it's just some stuff coming down chromatically. As I remember. I don't remember it right now, though.
It's kind of minor chords that have
minor chords coming down chromatically.
A different dominant attached to each of those, which gets you to the next minor chord.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then you guys did the beautiful arrangement of "Someone to Watch Over Me" with that beautiful intro that Herbie wrote.
Oh yeah.
Wow.
Right, and on that tour. It was Ellie DeGibri playing saxophone.
Yeah.
And Terry Lynn and Ira.
And you wrote this beautiful beautiful take on the changes of One Finger Snap.
Oh, yes.
You know what I mean? It's an intricate little melody, and then you blow over the changes of One Finger Snap. I'm wondering... Yeah.
Because only that first four bars is written.
Yes.
After that, it's just improvised.
Was this? Did you do this arrangement after the Herbie tour, where you played One Finger Snap a lot of times, or was it afterwards?
I used to play One Finger Snap before that tour, and then at the first rehearsal, I played it just like the record, like Freddie Hubbard played. Herbie Stops said, no, 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 no. That was on the record. Don't do it like that. So,
okay. Uh-huh. Yep.
Just like what we were talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you pick up the trumpet now these days, what are you working on?
Just basic. First, trying to get a nice sound.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the most important thing is sound.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not that impressed about how high one can play, or how fast, or how loud. The thing that touches me and all the people that I admire, whether a vocalist, a cello player, or piano player, or saxophone player, or trumpet player, is sound, where you can recognize somebody's musical identity just by two notes or one note.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the true mark of an artist. So that's why I try to instill on all my students. You know, like Gary Bartsch used to tell me, you know, Eddie, you can play one note a million different ways, textures of sound. So I try to experiment with sound. You know, when I practice long tones. I always practice soft. Miles Davis told me that.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you know, because on trumpet, flesh against steel, if I'm trying to get young trumpet players want a big sound, they're going to blow the chops away. Flesh against steel.
Mm-hmm.
So I always try to practice soft as a whisper. I can always play louder in the heat of passion. So I just do basic calisthenics, lip slurs, you know, my scales in every key. I used to practice licks where I could plug it in here and there. I don't do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I just let my ears be ready at the moment for what's happening around me, music at the time, where I can be appropriate. But in terms of practicing licks, no, that's not the name of the game for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some people still do that. I try and stay away from that.
Yeah.
And I always try to. A lot of musicians, trumpet players, they practice all day thinking they're practicing a lot. I just practice if I have a gig that night, sparsely in the morning, because I always want to come to the gig fresh.
Yeah.
I don't want to be kind of over practiced and warm, and by the end of the third set, I can't even make a sound. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Although I'm a pianist, so I'm very spoiled in that regard. You know, I mean, of course, we have to prepare and we have to practice, but it's not as physical as it is for a trumpet player.
Oh, yeah. Mm. To have longevity on the trumpet, you know, I used to ask Miles Davis, you know, in terms of vibrato, everybody has their own different vibrato. Miles' forte, or what he's known for, is no vibrato.
Mm-hmm.
I asked him about that. I said, why do you don't have a vibrato? He says, when I get old and start shaking, then I'll have vibrato.
It makes sense. When I had
Parkinson, then I have a vibrato.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, he was funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But even then, at the end, he didn't really have a vibrato so much, right? I mean,
No. That was just his signature.
Yeah.
And I used to ask Herbie about that, Miles' sound. He said, like, as opposed to, like, Lee Morgan, Clifford had his vibrato, Lee had his, you know, thing. I have mine, Woody Shaw had his, Harry James had his.
Mm-hmm.
Herbie said Miles's sound was like looking out in the universe, a monolith of a ice blue machine steel monolith. He says it's ice cold, but it's warm.
Wow.
I never forget when he coined it like that.
Yeah.
It's ice cold, but warm.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. When somebody brings a tune to you, Eddie, what do you appreciate? In a lead sheet, but also in vocal explanation. What do you appreciate?
Just give me the melody in my key in B flat, and that's it, and the changes.
Mm-hmm. Do you want the changes in B flat or in C?
In B flat. And the key of the trumpet, yeah. A lot of people read in concert. I can do that, but it facilitates me for my brain, the way I look at things. The melody in my key and the changes in my key.
Yeah. I've seen a few lead sheets of Wayne Shorter's that he wrote 4 miles. It even says 4 miles on the lead sheet. And Miles apparently used to read the melody in C, but the changes in B flat. No.
Oh.
Or the other way around. Like one of those.
Vice versa.
Yeah, one of those.
The melody in B flat and changes in C.
Yeah.
A lot of people, many people do it like that. I like them both in B flat.
Mm-hmm.
And the key of the horn. I just related better in my brain.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah.
What is the last standard that you've learned?
The last standard that sounds funny. The last standard I learned was it never entered my mind.
Mm-hmm.
On the last record.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I'd heard it many times by Miles, it was so stylized, I stayed away from it. I said, well, I just learned it in a different key, because he played it in A flat. I played in F. I heard the changes. I mean, I heard the tonality, the ballpark of sound, but I had whoever was on that record, the last record, I forgot who it was.
George Cables?
It was George. I had George write out the changes. Then it all made better sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah.
That's a beautiful, beautiful version that you played there on the record. When you came into this, to this thing, I was just still listening to it. And so I saw your face and was still listening to that version when you came in. So.
Oh,
it was very fresh.
That I just learned, You Know I Care, that ballad.
Mm-hmm.
By Duke Pearson.
Duke Pearson, yeah.
Yeah, I just learned that about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
A beautiful tune.
Beautiful, yeah. Yeah, we just talked about what you have to do or what you want to do on the day of a gig. Is there anything else that you feel like you have to do on a day on the day of the gig, or like things that you treat yourself with, or
Just normal stuff. Get a good night's sleep beforehand. Warm up in the morning. Don't touch the horn until I get the gig. And just maybe 10 minutes before I get on the stage, just do some long tones, real soft. And then come there and so my lips are fresh.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And listen what the band is doing.
Yeah. Most important thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. What music has recently inspired you or that really, really touched you?
Recently. Well, when I listen back to this stuff, I'll say the older stuff that used to inspire me and hearing it again, stuff like John Coltrane's Love Supreme. Wow. Unbelievable. John Coltrane's Expression, that album.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And also Interstellar Space.
Yeah.
I love it because I used to see John do that in person.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has meaning for me. And, of course, always going back in the past a little more, all my heroes, listening to Clifford Brown, his virtuosity, his sound, his creativity, listening to Freddie Hubbard and Lee Morris, and don't let me leave out Book a Little. He was unbelievable.
Oh yeah.
To reaffirm my passion, for playing this art form.
Mm.
Really, nothing that has been written recently have I been listening to. Just to reignite the spark that initially got me going.
Yeah. There's this album by Richard Davis that you played on.
Oh, I remember that one.
Yeah. And you're playing with Joe Henderson, Billy Cobham, and
Stanley Cowell.
Yes. How was it to blend with Joe Henderson?
Oh, he was such a grand master. He is so easy, you know. He just melted, you know.
Mm. Did you also play in his band?
He hired me a couple of times. Yeah.
Which configuration would this have been?
The first time he hired me is myself, Joe, Cedar Walton, Herbie Lewis, and Clifford Jarvis.
Oh, that's a cool drummer. I really liked Clifford Jarvis.
This is way back in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm. And you played all Joe's tunes, Joe's classics?
Yep. No rehearsal. He didn't ask me whether I knew it or not. He just started, but I've been listening to him. I just happened to know the melodies, you know, but he was awesome.
I think this is maybe this is a little bit lost these days, but I think this is how you would get a gig back in the day, if you just know the book of somebody and happen to be there and get a chance to sit in or be called, be at the right time at the right moment, but just know someone's music.
Absolutely. The reason he called me, he said, "This is Joe Henderson." I said, "Oh my God, you know, can you make the gig?" I said, "Yeah, when is the rehearsal?" He says, "Your credentials in order. You play with Herbie Hancock. I'll see you on the bandstand." So the first tune he calls was Invitation. So he played first. I was so excited. I played over my head. He took another solo. He sandwiched me in. So I said, "Oh, that was great, Joe. What do you want to play next?" He says, "Invite," meaning invitation. I said, "Well, we just played it." He said, "Yeah, but it felt so good."
Oh, wow.
He did it a second time. I swear to God, the third tune, Invitation.
No.
That was his favorite song.
Wow.
And each solo, he went to a different universe. I mean, it's unbelievable. He was so thorough.
Wow.
Yeah. And he told me, he said, "It's not about learning 1,000 obtuse originals. Learn one good."
Oh, yeah.
Anything.
And he
learned them very good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's something that when I talked to Billy Hart, he told me this. He said, it's not about how many things you can play. It's about how many ways you can play one thing.
Exactly. Exactly. Same thing that Joe was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah.
Eddie, thank you so much for talking to me and taking your time.